So, this is the beginning of our sequence of talks on the four reminders. So, I'm talking about what is entitled the preciousness of this body, but what it really means is the preciousness of a human birth, the preciousness of a human birth, of a human life. Previously, I have circled in samsaric existence like a water wheel, most often wandering in places of no leisure without meeting this excellent path. In this life, I have obtained a foundation of leisure and endowments, am cared for by an excellent spiritual guide, and have met the supreme path. To remain at ease now is extremely foolish. So it's interesting just to look at those lines in a bit more detail. So it begins with previously. So previously, particularly in Tibetan thinking, would be past lives, previous lives, and it can also be this life before we met the Dharma. And samsara is described as being like a water wheel, a place, something which has been very familiar to the Tibetans, that kind of relentless turning of the water wheel to get the water moving. And it's wandering, circled, so aimless, monotonous movement, repetitive movement, no change. So I started thinking about modern equivalents for that. So it could be like being on a tube train, endlessly going around the circle line. It could be like being in a factory, working on a conveyor belt. No rest, no change. This is the wheel. This is the wheel of life. It's the past. It's what was previous. It's our past. And the logic of this passage is that it could well be the future. And then we have in this life. So this life, here and now. So there's leisure, space, freedom. There are endowments, which are often called blessings. And blessings, I think, are also opportunities. Otherwise, they're not that great, really. Blessings enable us to move on. They enable more to happen. They're not part of a still situation. They're part of a creative situation. So this is about opportunities for change, opportunities for growth. And the passage speaks in superlatives, this excellent path. And there's also a first person immediacy. I am cared for by an excellent spiritual guide. I have met the supreme path. And then the conclusion, the climax, to remain at ease now is extremely foolish. So I think these lines are dramatic, they're urgent. And they're setting the scene for the later reminders. Now, this preciousness is familiar teachings. So you're probably familiar with the teaching from the Buddha about the old blind turtle. So I'll remind you about him. An old blind turtle lives for thousands of years at the bottom of the seven oceans. Once every 100 years, it surfaces for breath. There is also a golden yolk floating on the surface of the vast ocean, never staying in one place for more than a second. So, if you think that through, what are the odds of the turtle putting its head through the yolk? You wouldn't get very good betting odds on it. So it's extremely, extremely, extremely unlikely. And if the turtle just surfaces for breath sometime in those thousands of years when it's living at the bottom of the seven oceans, if it just surfaces for breath, it's born in the human realm. If it puts its head through the yolk, it has the opportunity to go for refuge. So it has heard the Dharma. So those are those are the chances, those are the opportunities. And actually, for us, it has. It's amazing, unbelievable. Against all the odds, we have been born into the human realm and we have the opportunity to go for refuge. And the other main teacher on this theme really is, I'm going to refer to quite a lot as Gampopa, the jewel ornament of liberation, a key Tibetan text, and a text that Bhante did seminars on. It's in the same tradition as the Four Reminders. And he elaborates much more on these particular freedoms and blessings. So I'm going to use him really to expand this teaching. And it brings us into contact with another very, very major teacher as well. So Gampopa talks about the eight freedoms and the 10 endowments. And a better term, I think, for endowments is blessings. And some of these freedoms are objective. They're in our external situation, and some are subjective. They're about us. And when they all coincide, which is a bit like the turtle getting to the top of the ocean, when they all coincide, it's called the unique occasion or the right juncture. And in terms of conditionality, this is all the conditions coming together. And then what happens? And it's what we often call this precious opportunity. Precious. Okay. And Gampopa, having the sort of long view of the vision here, talks about being human as being like a vase containing the elixir of immortality. So there's wonder there, there's vision there. And I will sometime put up the list of the of Gampopa's blessings and endowments. And I'm going through them today with a little bit of reorganisation to suit this talk, and because some of them overlap as well. So he talked about freedoms, and actually in his terms, our main freedoms are that we're free from birth in the other realms, the hungry ghosts, the animals, the asuras, the hell realms, the god realms. We're not in those realms. And those are the realms, of course, that appear on the Wheel of Life. And we could also say of those realms, though, that they're just all absorbing mental states. There's no variety of experience, and it's very difficult to get out of them. We're kind of stuck, we're fixed. It's the air of obsession, compulsion, neurosis. And it's interesting that includes the God realm, and I'll come back to that later in the talk. So the God realm, in a way, we're kind of blissed out if we're in the God realm, and it's deeply enjoyable. But there's no momentum to change. There's no spur to practice there. Why should one do it? And the God realm is impermanent. So by dwelling there, we just exhaust whatever merit has placed us there, and then in the end, it all runs out. So the God realm is not a good place to be, well, not for very long. Because what Gampopa says is that we need to feel the unsatisfactoriness even within comfort. We always need to feel that edge. We always need that spur to practice. And then he goes on to list our blessings. So we are born a human being, have a human life, and we're born in a relatively stable country, a country where we're allowed to practice. So those are objective conditions. And we have a mind which is capable of understanding the teaching. And this is a mind which is free from extreme wrong views. So our mind isn't fixed, closed down, not open to change. It's much more free, it's much more fluid than that. And what he's writing about there is the spiritual potential of human consciousness. And that means that we can have a varied response to experience, not bigoted, not fixed, and what Gampopa calls the slight misery of human existence. So it's not so awful that we can't deal with it. And it's not so blissful that we have no wish to change. So we're in something much more alive than that, and we can feel pleasure and pain. We suffer, but it's not overwhelming and incapacitating. We have ethical awareness, we have choice. We can be creative, we can work with our own samskaras. and we can benefit from karmic conditionality, which Hridaya Gita will be introducing later in the week. We can grow and change. This is about living, this is about being fully alive. We can experience shame, we can earn merit, we can act for the good, we can be kind. We have all this range of possibilities. And Bhante in the seminar says that we can develop qualities such as self-awareness, emotional positivity, responsibility, fidelity, cooperativeness. So in the freedoms, we have a positive objective situation, a conducive objective situation, and we have a mind that can enable us to open up to the Dharma. And then the other main blessings that he moves on to. A Buddha has appeared in the world. The Dharma has been taught. You have come in contact with the Dharma and found a teacher. You are capable of feeling compassion and love for the sake of others as well as for yourself. And Gampopa goes on to say that as a result of all these conditions, faith can arise. So there's a deep inner response, there's recognition, longing, aspiration for more. We're stepping out onto the path. So what's happening, this is that these are lists, but actually what's happening around this is something dynamic, transformative, very alive. So the freedoms and the blessings enable us to fully develop our human potential, our spiritual potential, and we can live lives which are truly meaningful. And Bhante says, with the blessings and freedoms, we're 2/3 of the way to stream entry. And he then says, the last third is the hardest. But the blessings and the freedoms that we have in our lives have enabled us to be here now, sitting in the Taraloka lounge on a quiet Sunday morning. All followers of the Buddha, all mitras. So I was going to just say something about the conditions that drew me to the three jewels, and then I'll go and look at some of the blessings in more detail. When I introduced my name the other night, I said that it meant completely blessed. So I have a connection with the blessings. And when Sangadevi, my preceptor, gave me my name, she said that in my letters to her, I'd often described myself as blessed. And I didn't actually sort of remember that. I didn't see that pattern, but I did have a sort of yes response when she said it. And all of us will have our stories. We're about to hear a little bit of mine. They'll be different, and there'll be a collective resonance. So I grew up in positive conditions. I grew up in a civilized country with religious freedom. I came from a stable family, not much money, but education, culture, nature. And I had a temperament that was seeking meaning. I think I was always on a quest. And then particularly later in adulthood, I encountered, as we do, suffering, self-doubt about who I was. I had a particular failed relationship which made me, well, not just regret the ending of that, but much more question my future and actually what was I looking for in life? What was my life going to be about? And I remember that time as, I remember it was dark days, and I have two sort of images from it. One is, well, when you begin to live on your own, you don't have to buy so much food. So I just have this memory of going to the local village shop on a Saturday morning and buying this little bag of sprouts, where I would know exactly how many sprouts I would need for my two meals. And that sort of embodied something about an individual lonely life. And I also remember one of those envelopes coming through the door saying, you have just won a wonderful prize. And I just thought, no, I haven't. But potentially, I was a vase, and still am, a vase containing the elixir of immortality. And then 5 years on from that, when I'd moved to Colchester, I just happened to be listening to Woman's Hour, where the highlights were repeated on a Sunday afternoon. I just happened to turn the radio on and listen to that. And there was an item about women who meditated. And I thought, yes, I'm going to learn to meditate this summer. And I did that. I stayed with that. And, oh, well, you know, it might never have happened. Maybe something would have happened at another time, but maybe it wouldn't have done. And then the next part is a bit of a blind turtle experience, really. I couldn't find anything in Colchester, although I think there was. And my parents, who lived in Norfolk, had lived next door to a cottage called Wilby Cottage, where at that time, which was the second half of the 1980s, two successive couples of order members had lived in that cottage next door to my parents. And actually another couple also lived in the same village. So at that time, there were about 30 Dharma Charanis. Six of them had lived in that village. Three of the Dharmacharis had lived in that village, and two of them had lived next door. And my mum was a good neighbour, and she knew them. And they had frequent visitors, and my mother used talked about looking out of the window and seeing someone in monk's robes walking around the next door garden. And she talked about taking in the mail after Padmavati was ordained, and seeing the change of name. So, and I visited my parents a lot, so I was actually on the edge of that world. So, actually, my mum suggested we invite Padmavati round, so she came round with a brochure for Norwich Centre, and we both went. But I was very, very fortunate. And then a year later, I came here. I came to Tharaloka for the first time, and that was hugely significant. And I was just deeply affected, I think, by the place, even though it was much less comfortable than it is now. This room was a barn, the new wing was a barn, everything was much more crowded, much more basic, but it had a real effect on me. And I was very affected to see women leading in a way that I hadn't before. So I felt as though my world was changing from monochrome to technicolour, and I had what we've probably all experienced, that sense of adventure and that sense of coming home. And I think my quest had become the noble quest. And I had just won a wonderful prize. And actually all of us have our own personal blessings and our own stories. So you can reflect on what drew you to the Dharma, what first brought you along, what made you stay, who helped or inspired you, your right juncture, your unique opportunity, your freedoms, your blessings. And our worlds are mixed, there's light and darkness, but these conditions are truly positive because they enable us to practice, because they enable us to move on, not just because they make life easier or more comfortable. So I'll look more specifically at the blessings. So the Buddha has appeared in our world. All those centuries ago, not lost, people meeting the Buddha then, us meeting the Buddha now. And all this actually draws me to the words of the Tiratnavandana, and I'm going to quote from those verses, points in this talk, because its words really resonate with the theme. Its words speak to those who've discovered the three jewels. And its immediate response to the Buddha is very fine. Such indeed is he, the richly endowed, the free, the fully and perfectly awake. And when someone met the Buddha, oh, they were so excited. It was wonderful. It was marvellous. When they met the Buddha then, but we in our own ways have met the Buddha now. But that feeling on meeting the Buddha can be described. This is Pakusa of the Mala clan in the Parinibbana Sutta, but it's a standard kind of description. What was overthrown has been set upright. What was hidden has been revealed. A lamp has been lit in the darkness. So things are in their right place. They're not upside down. They're not hidden. They're not dark. We can be as we truly are. And it doesn't always happen. There's the missed opportunity, the times and the conditions perhaps aren't all in place. So it's not the right juncture. And sometimes it's missed by moments. So the Buddha, enlightened, goes forth to teach, and he thinks about who to teach. So he thinks of his former teachers. And we have this list as Alara Kalama, but he died 7 days ago. This Utika Ramaputta, and he died last night. So they just missed it. a Buddha had not appeared in their world. And he sets off and he meets the monk Upaka. And the monk Upaka asks the Buddha good questions about who he is. And the Buddha explains, and he explains that he's the awakened one. And Upaka says, oh, that's interesting. And he took a sidetrack and departed. So Upaka walked off on his own, and his life became a sidetrack. And actually our life could become a sidetrack. So, I'm deeply moved to chant the words of the Tiratnavandana. Buddhang, Jivavita, Pariantang, Saranangachami. To say, all my life, I go for refuge to the awakened one. So I translate, I said that slightly inaccurately. I'll say it again. Buddhang, Jivita, Pariantang, Saranangachami. All my life, I go for refuge to the awakened one. And the next two blessings are about the Dharma. The Dharma has been taught, it is still accessible, and alive as a teaching. So going back to our first reminder, the Dharma is the supreme path. It's this excellent path. So this is the way things are, the nature of existence, a vision that describes the mundane conditionality playing itself out, and a vision which is open to the transcendental, the only thing that can meet our longing, our aspiration. And all of this is about our potential. We can be so much more. And we have the Buddha's description of what it's like to discover the Dharma. And this is actually his discovery. This is familiar. Suppose a man wandering in a forest wilderness found an ancient path, an ancient trail, travelled by men of old, and he followed it up, and by doing so he discovered an ancient city, an ancient royal capital, where men of old had lived with parks and groves and lakes, walled round and beautiful to see. So I too found the ancient path, the ancient trail, travelled by the fully enlightened ones of old. And actually, we too have found the ancient path, the ancient trail. And the Buddha, when he met people, he said, come, see, explore in the ways that Sujita suggested last night. So all these individuals that he met, merchants, mothers, beggars, bandits, he said, come, see, and to us. And the Tiratnavandana and the Dharmavandana expresses this in another way, ahipassiko. This is of the nature of a personal invitation. You come, you see, it's about you. And I remember myself, first time at Tararoka, sitting by the canal, reading the Buddhist vision and just saying, ah yes, ah yes. So I'm deeply moved to chant, Dhammang, Jivita, Pariantang, Saranangachami. To say, all my life, I go for refuge to the Dharma. So the next blessing is, I have come into contact with the Dharma and have found a teacher. And in the reminders, this is, I am cared for by an excellent spiritual guide. And the emphasis is on care. So this takes us to Bhante. And I could say so much, I'll just say a few things. But Bhante has made sense of it all for us, who's lived the Dharma life. And actually last summer I reread The Thousand Petaled Lotus, and the bit that really stayed in my mind actually was his such tough physical conditions that he encountered and that he took on. So Bhante couldn't wait to be ordained. So in India, in the unbearable heat of summer, he and his companion Satchapriya, day after day, walked along the railway track in unbearable heat to get to Kusinara to be ordained. And he couldn't wait 3 months for the weather to change. So there's that urgency. So Bhante, a complex, suffering, aspiring human being with a very fine mind. And he's given us the gift of the Dharma. All those books, all those talks, all those meetings with almost anyone who asks to see him. So he set up the conditions for us. And actually he's still doing it. You know, we're living actually in the sort of final days of his vision, in that whole period of the last papers. And that reminds me of Beethoven's last string quartets. You know, he's speaking, I think, from that space which is closer to death, when things are dissolving and you're seeing more. And he's saying what our contemporary minds can't yet fully understand, but hopefully future generations will. You know, so papers like Reimagining the Buddha, encouraging us to reimagine. And all of this gives us the tools to take responsibility for our own spiritual progress. And in particular, Bhante saw the potential of Sangha, of spiritual friendship, in ways which I think are quite revolutionary, both vertical friendship and horizontal friendship. And I think for me, actually, coming back into my first retreat at Tarloka and to times in this room, I just remember the team. Actually, I was quite isolated. I kept myself to myself. And my joke around this is I was the only person to have a solitary retreat with 30 other women. But there was so much unknown going on. So the team for that particular retreat, just my first retreat, well, it was led by Sangadevi, my private and public preceptor. Team members were Dayanandi, my Kalyana Mitra, also Sobhanar, a very long-standing friend, and Samatar, who would be on my ordination retreat. And at that time, I would never have guessed. And I'd never have guessed that those women would visit my house, that they would be lifelong friends. And our Tibetan texts don't mention Sangha so explicitly, but I do just want to give those some lines from the Sangha Vandana, of the Tiratna Vandana as well. So this is looking particularly to the transcendental Sangha, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, which Bhante has also transmitted to us. And actually those first enlightened bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, the ones who were once merchants and farmers and beggars and mothers and so on. So they're beautiful words. And I'm so moved by the lines, Punya Ketam Lokasati, an inexhaustible source of goodness to the world. And we can chant Sanghang Jivita Pariyantang Saranangachami, and we can say, all my life I go for refuge to the Sangha. So the three jewels are still accessible and alive, but what if they were lost? And at some moment in the future they will be, and in some individual lives they will be. So we can imagine. Maybe this is no longer a relatively stable country. Environmental chaos, financial collapse, political oppression. The world is lost and the Dharma is lost. Maybe you just find a tiny scrap of a picture blowing in the dust. You just make out a hand touching the earth. Is it the Buddha? You hold it, knowing it too is disintegrating. Or our minds begin to fade. Old age, dementia. And you think, there was a quotation, you're thinking, there was a quotation, something was the whole of the spiritual life. What was it? Something was the whole of the spiritual life. And I think for me, or maybe I might meet just one order member, the order being scattered. Maybe I meet just one order member, a Dharmachari among the ruins, who I would hardly have noticed in a queue at the convention. And now it means everything. But we're not there, we're here now, and we have so much. And we can all ask ourselves, do we do enough? Will we do enough? And what might we regret in our last lucid moments before dying, when things are dissolving? And there's, of course, much familiar teaching about the difficulty of taking up these opportunities, about practice, about our path, and I won't include much of this and how. But of course, we know also that we come from a position of existential ignorance. We know the pull of greed, hatred and delusion, and it can be relentless. And it's relentless because it doesn't bring lasting satisfaction, because it doesn't work. So the tendency is to keep on doing it. And so we keep going round the wheel, and the wheel can spin even faster. We're trying to fix samsara and we can't do it. And our contemporary world now is relatively stable. But there can be something insidious about that as well, because there's so much choice that within us we can have expectations that we can have what we want, that we can fix things, that we can sort things out. We can make samsara okay for us. I can make samsara okay for me. In this life, one can get away with it. So in good times, there's also complacency. And one could ask or reflect on what's the difference between complacency and contentment. Contentment. So complacency, we're out of touch with the truth of impermanence. There's no vision there, we're just attached to what we have, to positive conditions. With contentment, there's appreciation, not attachment. We know that things will pass, we know their true nature, and ironically, this is a richer experience, and we're closer to true happiness. But there can be dangers of a spiritual plateau. We can enjoy the benefits of a more spiritual life, better states of mind, good friendship, interesting study, but where is the momentum? And merit, I think, is an interesting term and idea. We probably have a lot of merit. It's brought us to our right juncture. Years of practice, we can shine with it. People notice it. But it's not a package, it's something that permeates our being. And the traditional teaching, merit is something we can just enjoy, we can be at ease now, we can be in a kind of God realm, but in the end we will use it up because it is impermanent. Or we let it be the condition for further progress, we let it really permeate our being, flow more deeply and creatively within us. So the human mind, consciousness, can make a real mess of things, but also it's a blessing with unbounded potential. We have minds that can meditate, reflect, contemplate. We have minds that can imagine. We have minds that can appreciate beauty. We have minds that can feel shame. We have minds that can gain insight. We have minds that can be suffused with faith. We have minds that can know the transcendental. And there was still that last blessing. You are capable of feeling compassion and love for the sake of others as well as for yourself. So this is the mind beyond the boundaries of the self, in living relationship, connection with all beings just as they are. This is head and heart, what the mind truly is, seeing and feeling and responding, trembling with another's suffering, standing alongside, acting skillfully, kindness, connection, metta, compassion, collective practice for the benefit of all beings. All beings suffer, all beings seek happiness. And then Sangha is an inexhaustible source of goodness to the world. And then we can transfer our merit to all beings. We can become a vase containing the elixir of immortality. We can live lives which are truly meaningful. And it was this mind that brought you to becoming a Mitra. It was this mind that brought you to your Mitra ceremony and all of us in the past. So that was where you held the delicate stem of the flower and offered it to the three jewels. Where you saw the flickering light of the candle and offered it to the three jewels. Where you breathed in the sweet scent of incense and offered it to the three jewels. And the Sangha witnessed this and rejoiced. So finally, here now, sitting in the Tararuaka lounge on a quiet Sunday morning, you have a mind that can benefit deeply from this retreat and can give to it. You have a mind that can make further spiritual progress. The possibilities are limitless. So finally, to remain at ease now is extremely foolish.